Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Fintech startups have long positioned themselves as the antidote to entrenched incumbents. Robinhood, aptly named, is democratizing investing, pitting Main Street against Wall Street. Chime positions itself as the bank that has your back. Whether or not these claims are true can be up for debate. But here's an even more interesting debate. Should financial service firms and fintechs even have impact as part of their platform? Jennifer Tesher, CEO of the Financial Health Network and host of the Emerge podcast, which you can find at provoke.fm. And I kicked it off, followed by four startups that are founded to be social impact crusaders. Asia Bradley, co-founder of First Boulevard, the unapologetically black digitally native neobank. Jimmy Chen, co-founder of Propel, that helps people who receive SNAP benefits, also known as food stamps, get back on their feet. Nicole Contrabecchi, general counsel at Dreambound, which promotes social mobility by making access for people who want to become a certified nursing assistant. And Ohad Zamet, co-founder of True Accord, that is fixing the debt collection process. What's your thought? Should financial service firms have to think about their impact? So Jennifer, it was almost on a whim a couple weeks ago. I posted a Twitter poll mainly to like the fintechy financial service nerds that we hang out with. And I was a little surprised how quickly, for like within an hour, 100 responses. And the question was,
I believe I was one of those 100 responses.
Yes, you were. Should banks and fintechs, you know, really have part of social impact is part of their brand? And I think the part that surprised me most is the overwhelming response, almost 70% was absolutely, followed by 16% said, if it is actually connected to the product they do. Now, the Financial Health Network, you know, on brand is actually, you know, social impact for you and kind of impact on the individual. I'm curious though, because you are backed by a lot of financial service firms, a lot of them, you know, for-profit enterprises. When you think about this broadly, what role should banks and fintechs be thinking about they play in this idea of impact?
I think without question, every company, every business is about impact. The question is what kind? Maybe it's a little more challenging or interesting for a financial services firm to think about because its products are somewhat intangible, right? It's zeros and ones, it's money. But there's this cartoon I like to use in conversations about or in talks about this subject. It's some children sitting around a campfire with a guy in a suit and tie, and his suit is all torn up and it looks like the end of the world as we know it, right? There's a little fire going, but nothing else exists. And the caption is, yes, the planet got destroyed, but for a beautiful moment in time, we created a lot of value for shareholders. I feel like every company has to be thinking about impact, because if they don't, there are not going to be any customers who can afford their products. We're not going to live in a world that sustains life. And whether they're doing it intentionally or not, every company is contributing to those issues. So I don't think this is a choice anymore. We've gotten to a point where these things are inextricably linked.
I was listening to the SP Global podcast this last weekend. You know, exactly the motivational thing you need while cross-country skiing. You know, go listen to SP Global's ESG, an ESG fully dedicated fund. But they were talking about how the CFTC had commissioned a study. I don't know if you saw it, on climate change. And it came back bipartisan, you know, study driven largely by, you know, players who, you know, have the data like an SP Global, but a lot of like the big financial firms and a lot of the big agriculture. And overwhelmingly, they came back and they said, you know, climate change in particular, not forget impact, you know, is an existential threat to economies and to life as we know it, needs to be included. And so when you talk about everyone needs to think about impact, are you thinking it's like they need to think about the like, for a brief period of time, like we drove a lot of value, or, you know, how does that play into like individual kind of, how do we impact an individual consumer's life?
Yeah. So I think it's all of the above. So when you think about what ESG stands for, right? E is for the environment, S is for societal, and G is governance. And the S, frankly, is squishier than it should be. I think it's largely come to mean sort of how you treat your workforce, your employees, but it also often is about the impact of your product or your practices on your customers. And because every business is so different, it's hard to create metrics, frankly, that will translate from company to company or from industry to industry, as opposed to, say, governance or environmental. It's a little bit easier to do that. And so I think when a couple years ago now, the Business Roundtable essentially issued a new statement on the purpose of the corporation, and they said Milton Friedman was wrong. Well, maybe they didn't really say that, but they essentially said, as much as I would like them to have said, Milton Friedman was wrong. Stakeholders are not the only, shareholders are not the only stakeholders that matter. And in fact, we need to really be thinking about stakeholder capitalism, about our customers, our employees, the communities in which we operate, our supply chain partners, et cetera. And you see companies really acting against this idea. And I think that for a lot of companies, the impact they ultimately have on the end user is a critical part of the equation.
Yep. Well, and it's funny, you know, I think back to my days in the mid-90s working at Monitor for Michael Porter, right? The raging debate within strategy circles is when this whole idea of shareholder capitalism kicked off. And to think about it, it took 25 plus years and climate change becoming a huge issue and societal pressures finally kind of cracking the veneer that, you know, the underbelly has issues that might need to be addressed. You know, it's curious that it comes up now. If you were to think about like the bank and the fintech's role in that, you know, when you talk to the banks that, you know, support you or that, you know, when you're addressing a conference, what role do you tell them they should be playing?
Well, our mission is really about financial health. And in my mind, whether they realize it or not, banks and fintechs are really in the financial health business because that's what their customers want from them. No one wakes up saying, I'm going to buy a checking account today. And so they have to be thinking about the ultimate value of their product or service to the end user, to their customer, because that's actually what customers are looking for in the first place. So I don't see this as being some do-gooder thing or, oh, this is the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. It is. Those things are all true. But this is a simple case of I'm in business to actually help people manage their money. Maybe I should help them manage their money in a way that's good for them. That just seems so obvious to me.
Well, it seems obvious, but, you know, let's look up to, you know, part of the run-up to mortgage crises. You know, there's unfortunately been more than one, right? Where it's the same trap we step in again, which is, hey, there's only so many houses being bought and sold. And if I am able to lend more, whether or not they can ultimately afford it or not, you know, that might not be in their best interest, but it's also pretty easy to convince yourself you're just helping them buy the thing they wanted to already. So how much responsibility do you think a fintech or a bank should take into actually helping them live a better life? You know, I think McDonald's learned this lesson, right? They're like, hey, you know what? We're going to start selling apple slices and these wraps, except, you know, as you know, the case study would prove out, you don't go to McDonald's if you want apple slices. You're at McDonald's because you want a quarter pounder and fries.
Although I will tell you that on the rare occasion that we are at McDonald's, that is what I buy, the apple slices. Listen, financial services companies like to think that all they sell is a neutral product or service, and that whether or not it's good for people is all about how people use that product. I just think that's a nice way to make yourself sleep well at night. But that's a complete fiction. We don't just control, as financial services providers, we don't just control the form of the product. We create everything about how that product operates, about the choice set consumers have in terms of how they use it, the policies that govern it. We have created everything about that construct, and we can choose to create that construct any way we want. Why shouldn't we be forced to be more creative in that construct so that we're making money because people are succeeding as opposed to the other way around?
Well, I want to pull on that because remember, this is when you and I became friends. This was part of the premise of Perk Street, right? The idea of adding a high rewards, real cash rewards that people can, you know, touch and use on top of a debit card and doing our best to manage the fees. But, you know, we like, you know, as much flack as Chime is getting in the press right now around, you know, saying no hidden fees, yet a significant portion is coming from ATM fees. It's like, well, those are pretty well disclosed. And you have to make money, you know, at some places. It's the question of how do you do it? And does the customer have a choice? Do they understand what they're getting? How do we reward that? You know, is that going to be a market-driven thing? Or is that something you think needs to be put into regulation? Or if it's a market-driven thing, does it need to be measured? That was one of the key things in the SP Global is, you know, unless there's consistency in the measure that can be presented to the shareholders, who I think by and large are waking up, right? BlackRock, you know, being the first big push of this to, you don't just think of me as your stakeholder, you better be thinking of shareholders. You know, how does that market evolution, how do we overcome, you know, where we are today to where we need to be?
Yeah, I think it's an and. I don't think it's a regulation or market will, you know, the be invisible hand. I think that there are things that individual companies can do that their shareholders and other stakeholders will reward them for. I think there are other things that industries need to do collectively from a self-regulation perspective. And then I think there are places where ultimately government regulation is required because there's simply a collective action problem. Because if enough firms get together and say, we want to have a high road practice, all it takes is one bad actor to have a low road practice. And everyone then has to join in the race to the bottom. So I think that there's a lot that industry can do on its own, but I do think there are places where without government action of some kind, you won't get sufficient high road practice.
Yeah. I mean, that tragedy of the commons problem, you know, can be pervasive. Although, you know, one that maybe needs to be teased out better, if you look at the oil and gas industry and just like the power industry in general, those are some of the most progressive players when it comes to getting to carbon neutral and to reinventing
now.
Now, right? Like for the longest time, it was the race to the bottom and, you know, the thin veneer on top of, you know, how little can I spend to have the best profile related to it? But now they've kind of bought into that, right? And they're fully committed to it, regardless of what regulation says.
Well, they have to be. The markets, at this point, their investors, their shareholders are demanding it. Because we've reached a tipping point as a society. I feel like one of the things that financial services industry has going in its favor is the information asymmetries. It's obvious when you're an oil and gas producer that you're polluting the world. You're helping to pollute the world.
Yep.
It's less cut and dry when you produce something, like I said earlier, that's so amorphous and intangible, and you can make a case that it's all based on the person's use of that product, their behavior in using it. So I think that even when you get a financial crisis or a mortgage meltdown, and there's still plenty of anger out there at the banks. We're seeing it now in the fight over who's going to run these financial regulatory agencies in the Biden administration. How tough are we going to be on the banks? That it's just a lot harder, I think. Banks can hide, frankly, better than, you know, a tobacco company.
Yeah. Although some of it is buried there. You know, I think back to the Perk Street days, and it's gotten better under the CFPB. But if you looked at the biggest banks, you know, 40 to 50% of their net income was being driven by fees, right?
Yeah.
And the majority of those fees were not.
The real question is, right, how much of those fees is coming from overdraft?
Yeah. Well, a significant percentage. I was about to say, we know that it was in the low double digits, but the very low double digits that were actually things where a consumer had a choice, like oh, I wanted to use this ATM and pay a $4 fee versus, you know, overdraft, which, as right. you said, it's easy to tell yourselves, well, it's how they chose to use it. You know, they wanted the breakfast burrito, and the fact that that breakfast burrito just cost them $35. Well, that was their choice, not, you know, something I forced them to do.
Well, and from a market perspective, it's if you're a bank and you say, I'm going to market my product on no overdraft. Well, the majority of people don't actually use or depend on overdraft. It's not a selling point. And the folks that do will go anywhere for it. So it's actually a perverse incentive.
So we found
a good example of where regulation ultimately is what's needed.
Yeah, we actually found, you know, the customers we polled, even people who routinely overdraft, all when asked would say they don't overdraft, whether they weren't paying attention or they didn't want to admit to it, right? Like, you know, to your point. And so I guess part of the question here becomes, you know, fintechs have leaned into this idea that, you know, we're more socially responsible and customer friendly than the banks. And I think, you know, over the course of the last few months, there have been more and more stories coming out in terms of, you know, fees and fees going up and, you know, charging, you know, for things that used to be free. Because it turns out you also do need a sustainable revenue model and you need to make money. Yeah, I mean, the little things. But how do we police this? Because this is, I think, where the tragedy of the commons begins to come in, which is if I can claim one thing and act another, you know, that's where the race to the bottom begins, like you said.
Well, just take one look at big tech. Say one thing, do another. Right?
Are you saying my data is not being sold?
So, you know, that comes back to haunt pretty quickly. You know, I actually think in the venture funded world of fintech, one of the biggest challenges are the VCs because they are expecting, you know, massive hockey stick growth and they're pouring tons of money into companies to get it. And at the end of the day, all they care about is their multiple and their ultimate exit. And that's where a lot of this stuff blows up. So, you know, I think the other thing, I would agree that, listen, fintech, generally speaking, is more customer-centric in terms of the design processes it uses to create product market fit. But that doesn't automatically mean that they are actually more focused on the customer's best interest at the end of the day. Those are two different things.
That's a very important distinction.
And listen, I give them all the credit in the world for being more customer-centric in terms of how they design their business. I mean, and in terms of the user interface, et cetera, that's really important, but it doesn't win the day.
Yeah.
I think there's things that industries can do collectively around best practices, around ratings and rankings. We, for a long time, have pulled together groups of companies to create best practices around not just the product structure, but around the policies that govern them. And in many cases, it's not about fees. Listen, products cost money. And if you really want someone to have skin in the game, a customer to have skin in the game, they should pay for it. It's in many cases, it's the practices, not the fees themselves. It's practices that drive people to have to pay the fee or to not understand the fee in the first place. That's what makes this so complicated. If it were as easy as saying, oh, everyone's checking account should look like this, okay, go do that, banks, we would be done. But it's not that simple.
So, last question related to this, it comes down to part of this idea of, you know, how do we drive more around the customer value related, you know, returns? How do we drive the visibility there? Is it going to take a few of the players to kind of start it and others will follow because the market, in theory, the non-VCs should reward it? Is it a regulated thing? Is it a coalition? Where would, like, if you got to be, you know, the queen for the day, what would you mandate to kind of wave your wand and make it happen?
We need to hold up the companies that are making money as a result of their customer success and really demonstrate, you know, hold them up as proof points. That's really what my organization is trying to do, among other things. I also think a really important thing is getting folks to actually measure their impact, because what gets measured gets managed.
Yes.
And it's really the cornerstone of what we're doing at the Financial Health Network. If you ask any fintech or any financial services company about what their dashboard looks like or their key metrics, they have a raft of them. Mm-hmm. It is not that they don't gather and track data, often at great expense. Think about the money that's poured into NPS, Net Promoter Score, as an example. And a lot of fintechs live and die by NPS. NPS is a great measure of whether someone enjoyed the encounter or the engagement they just had, but it has zero to do with whether they're better off as a result of engaging with you. And too many important decisions at financial services companies are being made on the basis of these NPS scores. There's a place for NPS, but it is not the same thing as measuring the financial health of your customers and your employees. And in our experience, once you do that, once you engage with a firm and you see what happens when they have that data, you can't unsee it. And it changes the way they start to think about what success looks like. That's what it's going to require.
Well, I think there's two things as we wrap this up to think about. One is you did a phenomenal interview, actually your very first interview on the Emerge podcast related to this with Dan Schulman.
Yes.
At PayPal. How does he think about that?
So, you know, Dan is poster child for this work. But interestingly enough, he's really gotten religion most recently about financial health as it relates to your own employees. And I like to say you put your own oxygen mask on first. You know, if your frontline workers don't feel supported by you in their financial lives, how can they be a good steward or representative with your customers? And PayPal started looking at a measure of how much net disposable income their employees have. And they were surprised at how low it was, because PayPal's a relatively high-paying, well-paying company, but they just didn't have the granular data. And once they had it, then they set a goal around it. We actually want our average employee's net disposable income to be X. I think it's something like 20%, pretty high, which would be great. And they started creating a whole set of programs and policies to make that happen. And now they're able to see how they're doing over time and make course corrections. It's pretty remarkable. And now, you know, given COVID and the world we live in, I think a lot of employers have become it's become obvious why they don't really have a choice but to be more engaged and focused on the lives of their own employees. And so in addition to taking action with your own customers, I think employees are an incredibly important stakeholder.
Well, and if it is your employees or you want to look at something deeper than what is my NPS with my customers, what should they be measuring? Well, the Financial Health Network happens to have put together a pretty phenomenal index related to this. Can you give us a quick description of the index and where can people go find it and use that as their launching point to really measure the impact?
Yes. Two sets of resources. On our website, which is finhealthnetwork.org, there's a toolkit, a free toolkit that tells you how to measure financial health. And then if you're looking for a more robust platform, we've actually just launched a new business called FinHealthCheck, finhealthcheck.com. And it also will introduce you to an end-to-end platform, a commercial SaaS platform that we've built to enable firms to embed financial health measurement in their day-to-day processes.
Fantastic. Well, as always, Jennifer, thank you for opining and bringing the Emerge podcast on to Breaking Banks. If you are interested in learning more, Emerge is wholly focused to this idea of the intersection of health and financial services, wellness, an array of topics, all really centered around that. So check it out at provoke.fm. Jennifer is the host and just phenomenal guest there as well.
Thank you, Jason. Always great talking to you.
The show is brought to you by Privacy. Start the new year off right by making your digital life more secure. Privacy lets you buy things online using virtual cards instead of having to expose your real card number, protecting your identity and bank information on the internet. Right now, new customers will automatically get $5 to spend on their first purchase. Go to privacy.com/breakingbanks to sign up now. With Privacy, you can control your subscriptions and recurring payments to make sure you're never accidentally billed twice or upgraded to another service without your consent. Save time with a Chrome or Firefox extension. Fill out all of your virtual card information with just one click. But what I like best is the card sharing feature. You can easily and safely send a friend, family member, or coworker a Privacy virtual card with just an email, and Privacy will handle the rest. It's also great for small business owners to safely share expenses with a team. Head to privacy.com/breakingbanks and sign up for an account. New customers will automatically get $5 to spend on your first purchase. Go to privacy.com/breakingbanks and sign up now. Breaking Banks listeners, in the coming weeks, you might see some new episodes pop up in your feed wherever you listen to the show. These are some special episodes we released outside of our normal weekly Thursday schedule, and this is just a one-time update to improve how we deliver the show. Going forward, you will receive all of our weekly episodes and any special episodes as soon as they are released, no matter where you listen. Thanks for your support in making this the number one global fintech radio show and podcast.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
The Breaking Banks Europe podcast brings you European unicorns, startups, founders, regulators, and leaders all innovating in the rapidly evolving fintech scene.
Hi, I'm Matteo Rezzi.
I am Ajit Tripathi.
This is Matthias Kröner.
I'm Megan Johnson.
I am Paolo Sironi.
I'm Nina Mohanty. Join us and some of the world's most well-known hosts and influencers in fintech as we bring you insights into European fintech. Find us wherever you normally listen to your podcasts or at provoke.fm.
Oh, I mean, you and I started actually part of this debate on Twitter, you know, going back and forth related to wellness. And you play in a part of this space that I think not everyone would naturally think wellness fits into the idea of debt collection, right? Because almost by definition, there has been a debt-like incident. I'd love first, can you give a little color commentary in terms of what TrueAccord does and where does this idea of like wellness and the customer centricity aspect of it come in?
Yeah, that's something that's not very intuitive when you look at a company like ours, but that exactly is the point. When you choose based on an actual like ethical vision on how the world needs to be in every interaction with the consumer, there's the way it's done now, and there's our way, which is completely different. And through technology, it's not only better UX, we also give up potential margin to serve consumers the way they want to be served. And thankfully, you know, we had this thought when we started and we discovered it was true. If you serve consumers the way they want to be served, they opt in to repay their debt, right? It's not coercive. They make a decision. If you put them in the middle, you give them agency and so on, they grab that agency because they're human like us and they want to be in control of their fate. Then you end up with a completely different product. And in a different world or maybe a different market, maybe we wouldn't even call this debt collection. But with the current regulatory regime, you know, for the past 70 years, we can't say, hey, we're actually not debt collector or something else. So we are a debt collector. Or we have a subsidiary that's a debt collector, to be more accurate. And that subsidiary uses the technology we developed to do something that is radically different. Now, the reason I invited these other companies here today is because I think these are companies that the same, not the same vision, but the same like brand or the same thinking drives why they were started. Meaning a vision of ethically, there's something today that works a certain way. It needs to work completely differently. And we're going to work to build the business that's thriving while doing the right thing versus, you know, due respect to Jamie Dimon, taking a knee in your $10,000 bespoke suit to commemorate BLM while your bank may or may not engage in practices that disadvantage people of color. That's the thing that we are cynical about, right? That's the benefit, the social benefit that we are kind of making fun of when you talk about social benefit.
So, Asya, First Boulevard, when you were founding, well, first give a little bit of description of First Boulevard, but how germane was this to the founding story about what you've set out to do?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks. Thanks, Ohad, actually, for saying that. And I will say, you know, what Ohad has done with True Accord actually was a big driving factor for, you know, how I started to think about fintech and the fact that it can do good and make money at the same time. So I want to thank you, Ohad, for, you know, I always say upon the shoulders of giants we stand, and you are one of those giants for me. First Boulevard is a digitally native neobank, and we're focused on improving the financial livelihood of Black America. So we really focus on that specific demographic in terms of, you know, there's a $1.4 trillion of economic annual impact for the Black community, but our population is just not really having any benefit from that. And so what we're finding, for example, there are reports that show that by the year of 2053, Black communities, like Black households, will have a net income of $0, right? And that's scary. And that's only going to be accelerated because of what's happening in the pandemic. Our goal really is to erase, I always say it in a very simple way, of get rid of racism out of the banking sector. I don't know if you're aware, like if you walk into a predominantly Black neighborhood, your minimum balance requirement on average is about $240 higher than if you were to walk into a predominantly white neighborhood, you know?
So it's So why is that? I'll be honest, I didn't know that. And I've spent a lot of time looking in the LMI space. I knew average balances were lower, but I had no idea that, you know, a required balance, you know, from a fee perspective worked that way.
Yeah. And you know, most of the time, the excuse that is given is, well, you know, we have fewer customers in that area. We have to still have the same overhead in terms of a brick and mortar building. We need to still staff that location. And so the costs generally are higher to be located in a lower income or, you know, what is tends to be a more melanated community as a result.
Nicole, I want to switch, you know, for you to Dreambound, and you know, first describe a little bit about what Dreambound, you know, is doing. But I'd love your perspective of, you know, where did this idea of social mission fit into the founding story?
So what Dreambound does is it helps job seekers obtain qualifications and achieve upward mobility. And to the point just made, there is definitely some misaligned incentives for this group trying to get more qualifications and increase their mobility. Job training programs under 14 weeks in duration are not eligible for student loans. So these job seekers are going to banks that have higher minimum requirements and all the rest. These are usually thin file borrowers or no file borrowers who can't get credit and can't afford the exact thing that will lift them up and help them have better economic stability. So we are achieving social good, and I think also building a sound business by absorbing some of the costs into other parts of the system that are better placed to absorb it, by accessing referral fees from training centers that are looking for students, by going to employers who are desperately looking for qualified nursing candidates, and using that to allow us to create affordable ways to finance tuition and get people qualified. Because the minute they have that job, they can repay.
Jimmy, you know, this idea of upward mobility plays directly into Propel's mission. If you could share, you know, quickly what Propel is doing, this idea of that, you know, virtuous cycle that I think Nicole talked about, right? Which is, if you can break the downward cycle of it and get people into the thing they need to actually move up, they can repay. Where does Propel fit into that spectrum?
Yeah, You know, Jason, the thing that I was just reflecting on hearing Nicole, Asya, and Ohad talk about their ventures and how they commit and how they fit here is that these are three amazing examples of how injustices in the world can also be market failures. Whether it's racism in banking or a mismatch between skills and jobs or the way that the debt industry is working, these are all also market failures, right? And I think that entrepreneurship has a real role to play. For us, what we are focused on is the usability of the social safety net in the United States. So there are 40 million Americans who are on food stamps. They get their benefits on an EBT card, and they check their balance and see their transaction history, not through a mobile banking app, but by calling a 1-800 number. So we fix that by building the modern mobile banking product for people who have EBT cards and get food stamps in the United States, and are really focused on financial health and helping our users to save money and make more money.
So I want to build on that for a second with you. So, you know, I love this idea of like a market failure. You know, one could, if you want to put this positive spin on it, is say it's a market asymmetry, right? And every venture capitalist knows when there's an asymmetry, that's the thing you go take advantage of. But, you know, you're going after this specific part of that market failure. When you went to go raise money, you've got a phenomenal set of backers. What was the feedback you got, you know, when you're going after, you know, this part of the asymmetry where it's like, you know, it's a hard part, and how do you make money by doing things that are free and helping, you know, people, you know, have that, you know, better choice of what they're going to go do?
Yeah. So the single biggest challenge we've faced in fundraising, and we're fortunate to have really smart and mission-aligned investors from a variety of firms. The biggest challenge is not a lot of investors have been on food stamps. And so there's not a lot of people who understand the types of problems that we solve. I've talked to a lot of investors whose natural instinct when they hear a startup pitch is, well, is this something that I would use? Or is this something that my wife would use? Right. And my company failed that screen for almost every investor we've ever spoken to. Just it's not even relevant. And so that was a hill we had to overcome. You know, the way that we do make money as a for-profit venture-backed business is the app is free for users and free for governments. We help people to save money and make more money, either through a referral fee to a cell phone or to a job, or in other cases, to a financial product.
Yeah. All I can think right now, like when you describe the, you know, this isn't something that resonates because it's something they live through. It's like you clearly needed to go to Arlen Hamilton at Backstage Capital. Like she's the one investor out there that you know. It's like she gets exactly what you're talking about. Asya, I'm curious from your point of view in terms of where what you're going to go serve, you know, when you go talk to business partners and to raise funding, you know, what was the response where social mission came into it? Was it treated as a marketing expense? Was it core to the business? Was it treated as like the, you know, it's something we, you know, do almost begrudgingly, or, you know, was it captured that it was core to the market?
You know, it was actually quite surprising. So when, you know, when essentially we started the company over the summer, and for us, the tipping point was when George Floyd happened, you know, so my co-founder and I were both kind of, we felt it like a punch in the gut, when George Floyd was lying on the pavement, crying out for his mama. Both of us, you know, Donald and I were just like, oh my gosh, like we cannot continue what we're doing right now. I quit my job. You know, he already had a successful, fintech company that he was the CEO and founder of as well. He found someone to run it in his place. And we both were like, we are just going to bootstrap this and make it happen. You know, his wife was expecting their first son. I've got three sons of my own. And we easily could imagine our own sons in that position. And for us, it really became an absolute mission, not just a mission statement that you hire a consultant and try to put on a whiteboard, but it really was something that we felt in our heart and our soul that we needed to do. And so we knew that whatever, come what may, we were going to make it happen. We were quite blessed, actually, in that we started putting together our deck and we started talking to different folks. And we realized that there are a lot of amazing people out there that also feel like we do. And before we knew it, we had some introductions and our seed round was put together. And in November, we raised. So the announcement will be coming out pretty soon, but it was a multi-million dollar raise from very top tier VCs that actually cared. And it was one of those situations where I think the timing was right, I think it was that perfect storm that brewed and brought, you know, our VCs to the table, that suddenly they saw what everybody else around us saw. And so I think this timing is the right timing for businesses like, you know, Jimmy's and for Nicole and Ohad's. This is the right time to actually start thinking about our own social responsibility and melding a profit business with social responsibility and showing that it can happen.
So I want to broaden this. Nicole, you had a response to that.
I was just going to jump in and say, I wonder how much of this is just really market failure and how much is a failure of imagination by very cookie cutter VCs.
Yeah, I think that too. And also, you know, I think it really has to do with the social space around us. I think the social space, people weren't willing to be as open and direct and unapologetic about what is happening in our society prior to this. And I think there was a lot of politeness, right? And the unwillingness, or let's call it willful ignorance, and about what was happening in our country, you know, that sort of enabled a lot of the political situation to kind of bubble up to where it was, yeah, a couple of days ago, and still is, right?
Well, I think that willful ignorance, you know, 200 plus years of a willful ignorance mm-hmm. attached to it, combined, Nicole, with what you described, which is, you know, if a lot of venture can be based on pattern recognition of leaps and bounds, there is no pattern recognition related to a lot of this. Ohad, I'm curious on your perspective, you know, there, because there also is not a lot of pattern recognition that you can say, hey, you know, people are going to go opt in to go do the right thing. If anything, I would say the general belief in the extreme of a capitalist market is their self-interest leads them not to do something like that.
Yeah, you know, we don't have enough time to talk about capitalism and ethical stances. This is a longer discussion. But look, Truck Court, we raised more than $90 million. We're 300 people and growing. We're a growth stage company with a really big footprint and continuing to grow, right? So not complaining. It has been harder. I don't think it's a company that could have been started by someone without a few liquidity events and successes in his past, because it would be much harder to raise money. Look, definitely a failure of imagination. There's definitely a binary. If the investor has ever been in debt or even got one call about debt, much easier to talk to them about the problem. But it's also, when you look at our ecosystem, you know, these are companies, we are basically an enterprise company, right? We sell to the lenders, we work with hundreds of lenders, we have 6 million active consumers that we work with, and we get 500,000 to 1 million more every month. That's scale, right? But when you start out and you basically need to pay Facebook or Google to acquire consumers or find other growth hacking strategies, and you're trying to help consumers who don't have money, right? I think maybe us as company aside, when you are trying to acquire consumers and those consumers don't have money, that is a challenge to grow a company. And that's the fascinating thing for me about Dreambound and about FreshGPT, right? Companies that are different stages, but growing and continuing and accelerating in an environment where you need to acquire those consumers and retain them, that is very interesting to me to hear about.
Well, Nicole and Jimmy, I want both of you to jump in. And Jimmy, like, build on that, because for both of you, like, social mission is like literally embedded in the product that you have. Not that yours isn't Asya or Ohad, right? But it is part of your strategy. But it is part, versus for both Dreambound and Propel, it's like the FreshGPT product, it is part of the product. Like, you can't extract it from the product and have it be the same thing.
Yeah. In the early stages of Propel, we actually tried to make an intentional choice to make that the case. So there was an earlier version of the company where we were building software that helped people to enroll in food stamps, kind of like TurboTax for enrolling in government programs. The idea at the early stages was like, let's build that for these social safety net programs and also apply the same technology to, applying for a driver's license or something that a wealthier person might pay for, and then use that to like cross-subsidize. We ended up not pursuing that model primarily because of the reason of like, it would make the social impact a bolt-on to the company as opposed to the core thing that we were trying to do as a company. We started the company to serve low-income Americans, not as a side project, but like as the thing that the company does. And so we scrapped that particular business model. This actually, I wanted to ask Ohad a question referring to something that he had said in the introduction, which is he had said that like he sacrifices, I think you said, some amount of margin in order to be a social mission-driven company. And I'm curious if you would agree with the characterization of it's a matter of time frame. Like maybe you're sacrificing margin in the immediate, in this month or this quarter, but you're building a company that can be more enduring in the long term? Or do you see it in a different way in terms of the way that social mission applies to your business?
Yeah, you're making an excellent point. I think it's not only about creating an enduring company. It's also, here's something that's shocking to us. We think about consumers, of course, anyone who's never been in debt always thinks about consumers in debt as either villains or victims, right? They're either the deadbeats sue them or they're the victims, leave them alone. And the reality is that these are people dealing with trauma, getting out of trauma, and they want agency and they want to control their life. What the other thing that we think, and that historically the industry thought, was consumers in debt, when they have money, the first person to call them, get them on the phone, gets them to pay because they can pressure them to pay, they can turn their screws. The reality we found is that consumers make rational decisions about where to spend their marginal free dollar of income to pay down debt. And that is based on size of debt, that is based on APR, and with us, it is also based on brand. And that's the point that I was trying to make. We have been around enough, and we've worked with so many consumers, 16.5 million consumers so far, that when we send a message to a consumer, we have an established brand. When the consumer says, I like these guys, they treat me well, I can find information about them online, when I have money, I'm going to pay them. And by the way, consumers come back and tell us, oh, can I bring you all of my debts? Can you help me with other financial issues? I mean, I don't want to talk about that too much because we haven't announced anything in this area, but that's exactly the point. You give up something up front, you create a long-term relationship. It's also high LTV. But again, failure of imagination, that's a great point. You have to be able to paint that vision and you have to find the investors and the employees, by the way, who will leave that. That is a challenge. It takes time.
I will just add on to that and say, although Dreambound had a core proposition about creating social value, one of the surprising things is the pandemic has actually made it easier for us to fulfill that. There's been a lot of new thinking in terms of training for vocational programs. Typically, they had to be all done, you know, full days or half days in person. Transportation was really difficult. They weren't flexible with people's programs. And that's something that's really had a huge shift in the pandemic. And it's made it much more available for people who are struggling to keep things together as it is. And so bizarrely, I think, if anything, the social part has improved, and I think we're actually being able to add greater value to our customers.
Well, I want to build on this. You know, this conversation has gone far too fast. We should have done like the entire episode versus a segment on this. I want to start with you, Asya, on, you know, there's this really delicate line when we talk about creating a social impact and driving good. But sometimes, you know, let's face it, customers don't always do the thing that is best for them. Like, I would eat more salads than pizza if that were the case, right? And I know well enough that's what I should be doing. Where does that fit, you know, when you start to think about, you know, your mission and obligation, but still this idea of, you know, free will and for the customers, how do you begin to protect them from themselves and how far do you go?
For sure. I mean, that's actually a really great question. I just wrote a piece about this the other day, and it's titled, Black Americans Are Not Broken. The financial services industry is. And I think it's when you turn that around and you say, it's not the people in debt that are the problem. They're not broken. It's the system that is putting them in a situation where they're not able to actually be empowered to take action. And that's, you know, what TrueCourt has built. So on our side, it's a matter of, you know, it's not that Black Americans just don't want to have bank accounts. It's the fact that if you're treating them unfairly and saying you've got to have $240 more than your white counterpart, well, why should they be part of this? You know, this is not a fault on Black America. If you look at, for example, fees and fines, Black Americans pay on average far more, I think it's 5x more than their white counterparts do. So why would you participate in a system that is so rigged against you? It's designed by white colonialism and imperialism to keep you down, right? So we're talking about a place, an America, where sure, Black lives are being taken in the streets by a force that was set up supposedly to protect them. But instead, that's not where this all begins. Black lives are taken when Black poverty is being forced down their throats by the systems that were designed in order to do this. So a lot of times we talk about how do we help Black people, you know, do better. I think we need to change the system, build a new system that actually allows people to thrive and doesn't keep beating them down. That's where the debt starts, right at the root of the financial services industry. They're not broken. The services industry is.
I absolutely agree. And to echo your earlier point, you know, I think the banks have failed in that they will not take on the small loans that are really needed. And instead, that's been shunted over to a very consumer unfriendly payday lending industry. They can't do the small loans. FinTech has stepped in there, and I'm encouraged to see what's going on there. Similarly, where Dreambound's trying to help, you know, these loans are simply not available to the people who need them most because they don't qualify under the federal guidelines. And I think there's a real need there of a whole section of the population that's being failed.
Something that I want to call back to with Asya's point about root cause and what is the root cause to a lot of these things. One of the things I like to say when it comes to our population at Propel, people on food stamps, like the root cause of poverty is not having enough money, right? It's not laziness or stupidity or poor choices or whatever other rationale you might have. And I think, but I mean, like, so we hold that very true, right? That it's like the absence of money that makes people get into these really challenging life situations when it comes to safety net programs, like the food stamp program, the types of choices they have to make. But I think it's also true that there are a lot of behavioral, economic, and cognitive biases that are well studied when people are in scarce environments. When you are forced to choose between paying your rent or paying your cell phone bill or purchasing some diapers for your kids, people can be put in very challenging, emotionally challenging situations where they're forced to act sometimes not in their long-term best self-interest. And I do think there is a role for fintech and for financial services as a whole to help people to eliminate those biases in certain situations and to give people all the information and the tools that they need in order to make the decisions that they themselves want to make.
Excellent, excellent points from everyone. Jimmy, that was amazing. I will just add that sometimes the process itself is Kafkaesque. And if you're in debt and you don't know what you're doing, and you don't as a consumer, there are certain words that if you told them to your collector, you will end up being sued and your wages garnished. And you just don't know that. Because there's a misalignment of information, there's an engine that will crush you if you don't work with the right partners. And that is something that we have to mediate. And this is a lot of the time, this is where we step in to find that match where the mismatch existed.
Well, let's build on that, even because this will go over time. Last question related to the group is, can the market take care of itself, right? Because the system is broken. Oh, I love the statement of the machine, right? Like there is a machine that now exists, and the entrenchment that Asya talks about that, you know, it's difficult to change, right? Like a market failure does not tend to correct itself very easily. So can the market correct itself, or is this a place that, you know, it does need greater regulation or other incentives? Maybe the answer is not regulation.
Or that's a super loaded question. No, I don't think regulation is needed. I'll give you the shortest answer. Okay. There is an ethical line that passes between I'm selling candy to kids, LOL, here's some apple, to pretend like I'm helping them with good nutrition, to the government stepping in and forcing me to behave or shutting down my company. There's an ethical line that we have to discuss, right? And I would say at this point, TrueCord is an example, and I think other companies are an example, that you can choose the ethical decision. You can build something that is a viable business that can be profitable, can make a lot of money, can hire a lot of people, you know what? You may not go on TechCrunch every other day. Maybe we don't care about that. Maybe we care about people first. And that's fine. That's our choice. And I think it's the right one.
I think there's been a real failure of regulation. I think on the one hand, regulation has focused rightly on the bad actors and going after and punishing them. But I don't think they have allowed enough space for people to operate clearly and ethically and safely. I think there's so much that companies have to wade through to understand the areas where they can safely provide a product. And I think if there was, you know, there's been so much talk about regulatory sandboxes, and I don't think we even need sandboxes. I think we just need safe harbors that are clear.
No, that's great, Nicole. And I wanted to add on in terms of the regulatory framework, I mean, it can only go so far. So if you take the example of KYC, know your customer, that's something that's set up supposedly to prevent one thing, but then it opens up a whole other can of worms on the other hand, which actually disadvantages the very communities that, you know, all of us are trying to serve. I've myself, for example, fell into an invisible person. So as a Pakistani Canadian immigrant moving to the United States, I was able to have sufficient capital to start up a business, but the only credit card that I could get was a $500 secured card from Chase. And I was only able to open a bank account by physically visiting the location several times and also getting my brother to co-sign for me and verify that I am an actual live individual.
Jimmy, where do you think when you obviously are solving a piece of the puzzle that the expectation would have been, you know, this could easily be pushed back, say it's a government problem, yet you've managed to go build, you know, a business around it. You know, are there other incentives that you see that can spark more innovation like this that the markets can correct themselves?
I think the easiest thing to prescribe is allowing people with different experiences to start companies, lowering barriers for entrepreneurship, allowing people with a diverse set of life and world experiences to give them the tools, in many cases, the software tools, to start a company that can address some of those challenges. I think that is that's actually one of the premises behind this program called Blue Ridge Labs. It's through the Robin Hood Foundation. It's how I started my company 7 years ago. It's this idea that people solve the problems that they understand. And tech entrepreneurship and fintech entrepreneurship in particular has been limited to a subset of the population for probably too long. But the problems faced by Americans across all spectrums are not limited to the subset of the problems faced by tech entrepreneurs, right? And so getting like whatever we can do to reduce barriers to starting a company, to building a prototype, to raising money, those are all the things that I think enable other people to solve different problems that maybe aren't being solved by the systems that the market failure is not going to, you know, correct on its own.
Alternatively, we could make all venture capitalists, bankers, and fintech entrepreneurs go live on food stamps while going and getting another degree, you know, based on a trade, and put them into some level of debt, dealing with debt collectors, all while facing systemic racism and other parts of the financial system, you know, loaded against them. I think that's probably going to be harder to pull off than going with getting more entrepreneurs into the system, though.
I mean, I think that, like, the more we can do, the better, right? There's actually one of our partner organizations really has this effort around, you know, everyone can spare 5 minutes to go through the application form for food stamps. Like, you're not too busy to, like, find out what it's like for the tens of millions of Americans that need this to go eat, right? And so, like, that's actually, it's not the same thing as stepping in someone's shoes, but it's better than not knowing anything about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, thank you all for, you know, being busy in your time, and time is unfortunately money and you have so little of it, but also thanks for making a difference and stepping out and driving that piece home.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.